The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever. We look at stories from business leaders who have dealt with anxiety, depression, or other mental health challenges, how they fell down, how they picked themselves up, and how they hope workplaces can change in the future. One thing I've been noticing since the pandemic began in media, news, social media, and the public discourse is really an increasing awareness of mental health, an increasing conversation volume about mental health and how it affects us. And that is great. And it's a huge purpose of this show. Another purpose of this show is to talk about the unique ways mental health issues, neurodiversity, can actually help people succeed and thrive in their careers. But as much as anxiety or other struggles might drive someone to succeed, there are many mental health issues that can arise because of a life that you feel like you didn't quite get. Opportunities missed out on. Anxiety that comes from feeling stuck in your life and your career and wanting things to be different. The big what ifs. That's a bit of the storyline behind a show that I became obsessed with recently, Mr. Corman on Apple TV Plus. It's a story about a fifth grade teacher, Mr. Corman, as he deals with loneliness, depression, and dreams unfilled. As channeled by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays him, Corman experiences anxiety on screen in such a real and touching way. I really felt so seen.
He goes, "It just makes me feel small."
Oh my God.
I know. I just love him. He's such a heartfelt, thoughtful guy.
Does the universe make you feel small?
Yeah. Doesn't it for you?
Well, that's not the main thing I feel when I look at that picture.
You know the big picture?
Yeah, dude. I grew up here. I've been to the Griffith Observatory.
Right.
I love the big picture.
So do I.
But you just said it makes you feel small.
It does.
You know, anxiety can cause us to be narcissistic. It can drive the people around us up the wall. But it can also make us really sweet and vulnerable and deeply human. And that comes out in Mr. Corman. So I'm super excited today to kick off season 5 with actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who not only plays the title role in the series, he also wrote and directed it. And as Gordon-Levitt will tell us, he's actually a manager and an executive, even though he's a Hollywood star. So we'll talk about that. Gordon-Levitt says Mr. Corman is actually one of his most personal projects he's ever done. Hi, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Hello. How are you, Maura?
It is so cool to have you on the show. You have said that this is the most me-ish, I'm not sure that's a word, but I like it, me-ish project you've ever done. And why?
I guess a lot of it has to do with the aesthetics of it. It's very much to my taste in terms of what it looks like and what it sounds like and, you know, the music and everything else, the acting, the humor. It's very dry humor, which tends to be what makes me laugh. But I think it's also probably me-ish in that the story sort of started with me. Mr. Corman, Josh Corman, he's not me. I'm not playing myself, but he's sort of a version of myself, in that the beginning of this character was me thinking about my own life and how things could have been differently, feeling incredibly grateful for so many things, incredibly grateful for having met my partner that I love so much, and we have our kids, and I've had two great parents, and I get to do work that I care about, and I'm healthy, and I live in a safe place. I'm grateful for so many things. I also think that a lot of those things just come down to luck. I wonder about that all the time, and I started writing about it and writing about, well, what if my luck had been different in this case or that case? What if I hadn't met my partner? what if I just hadn't met the right person for me yet? Or what if one of my parents was more of a chaotic personality and less supportive and positive? Or what if I didn't get the lucky breaks to get to earn a living as an artist? What would I do? And I've always really admired teachers and been drawn to that. And so I made him a teacher. And you know, this is the kind of process that resulted in this character of Josh Corman, which sounds sort of like Joseph Gordon.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, and that's perhaps another reason why I called this show Me-ish, which is a word. You can look it up.
Okay, challenge accepted.
I just lied. That was a lie.
it's funny because I think a lot of people who are sort of anxious overthinkers in life might have this sense of what if. And there was an interview with you in the New York Times, and the reporter, I think, said, from gratitude, your gratitude sprang a sort of existential anxiety, right? Like this what if. Was there any piece of this that came from like that feeling of an anxious place, or was it more curiosity, or was it both?
Well, I think probably both, to be fair. But yeah, for sure, a lot of it came from an anxious place. I think a lot of times when I'm writing, I'm trying to calm my mind down. Or our brains are built to do that, right? Our ancestors, our biological ancestors running around in the wild, had to constantly be on the lookout for what was going to kill them. Weirdly, we now live in, or I should say, some of us, all of us should, but only some of us do live in materially comfortable lives where we don't have to worry about something jumping out of the bushes to eat us, and we don't have to worry about where we're going to get our next meal, etc. And so our brains evolved to foresee problems, but the problems that our brains are evolved to see aren't really part of our lives anymore. And so we find other problems to focus on, and then we write them down and tell stories about them.
It's so true. It's so true. My husband always says, well, if you get over that one anxiety, your anxiety is just going to go someplace else, because
definitely,
that's how your brain works. It's like seeking. There's no tiger jumping out from the bush, but it's true. Well, so you've talked about, this is a show about leadership and anxiety and mental illness and mental health. You have said that you struggle with anxiety. I don't think you have a clinical diagnosis, but it seems like you consider yourself an anxious person, and I'm curious how that manifests. Like, what's
your relationship? Have my sense of humor. For some reason, that makes me laugh when you say that. And if that makes you laugh too, then you'll laugh a lot when you watch Mr. Corman. Do I consider myself an anxious person? It wouldn't be the first word I'd use to describe myself, but if I'm honest, it would definitely have to be in there. And you're right. I did go talk to a doctor about it one time a couple years ago, and I don't have a diagnosable anxiety disorder, but I think a lot of us have, there's a gradient here. I do have a number of people in my life who I'm very close with, I care about a lot, who do have more diagnosable anxiety that they struggle through. And it's incredibly common, as I guess anybody listening to this might know. I learned that one out of every six people in the United States is going through a diagnosable anxiety disorder, and that's just the diagnosable kind. So there's a lot more than people like me who might not come away with that kind of diagnosis, but are still wrestling with some feelings. And part of what I wanted to do with Mr. Corman was destigmatize it. And obviously one show is not going to do that. So do my small part to help move the conversation forward and destigmatizing it. It seems like we're moving in that direction in our culture, and that's a great thing. Historically, there's such a stigma that people don't want to talk about feelings of anxiety because they'll be told, hey, quit whining. Hey, yep. Buck up, hey, get a grip. Be more positive. Quit complaining.
Well, that's what Josh's mom kind of tells him.
Yeah, she does. Her reaction is not entirely perfect. But I'll also say, I don't think Josh is blameless. He is, and I think probably a lot of anxiety is complicated, and there is a degree to which you can't do anything about it. It's just a disorder. But there is also Josh is guilty of perpetuating a negative attitude in addition to the anxiety that he's going through. And I think that complexity is part of what makes it so hard to deal with. You know, I did show this script and get input from a doctor of neuropsychology. And she did say, yes, I would say based on this script, probably, you know, I'd have to really talk to him more to make a real diagnosis. But it seems like he exhibits a lot of the same things that people do have. And so, yeah, I I think that's a really tough one to parse. And that's part of what's to me really interesting and complicated about the story.
So you've had a long career in Hollywood, but you're also, from what I've read about you, you're creative, you like to make music, you act and direct and produce and write. How have you learned, maybe as someone who is an overthinker and anxious, to separate the love of the craft from all the pressures? I can't even imagine what it's like to have to manage your career in Hollywood, like how stressful that could be.
It's a good point, and you're making, I think, the right distinction that there's the art and creativity, and then there's the show business part, and they occasionally overlap somewhat, but mostly, to me, it's important to guard and to separate the art part of it.
How have you learned how to do that? Like, how have you taught yourself to do that?
Good question. The first thing that comes to mind is acting on a set is something I've been doing ever since I was a little kid. And so I think I've drawn a lot of skills from doing that are beyond just the acting part. One of the things you have to do on a set is focus. You're surrounded by distractions. You're trying to embody a character who's standing in a room with, for example, one person and having an important emotional conversation with that person. But in reality, you're not in a room with one person. You're in a room with like 20 people. And all these lights and a camera and a microphone, and you have to tune all of them out. And by the way, all those people are just making tons of noise doing their work so that we can make the movie, all right up until 5 seconds before you have to start the scene. You know, everyone's making all this noise, and then suddenly someone says, rolling. And then they say, speed, marker, and action. And those words to me have become like almost a sort of a magic spell where I'm able to just kind of tune all that stuff out. All of it just goes away. And that's a skill that I think I probably apply not just on set when I'm acting. When you're asking, how do you just focus on your own self-expression, and how do you tune out the voices in your head saying like, oh, you got to think about your career, you got to think about your momentum, your heat, your blah,
exactly.
blah, blah.
Exactly. Well, and also other people probably judging you all the time and, you know, giving unsolicited advice, and people just managing you. I would imagine there's just a lot of like relationship management that comes with being a star.
I mean, I I've been doing it a long time. And so the people that I work closely with, I think are all, I'm lucky that I've been able to surround myself with a bunch of really good people that are kind and understanding. Like, for example, when I became a dad, I took a bunch of time off work. I didn't set foot on a set for 2 years. And that was the longest I'd ever gone, ever since being 6 years old. And my agent at the time, you might expect a cliche agent to be like, don't do it. You'll lose all your heat. But he really didn't do that at all. And he played it so perfectly. He was honest with me, but completely supportive and warm, and said, look, as your agent, it's my job to tell you that, of course, there will be consequences to your career for doing this. But as your friend and someone, you know, I've known you for decades and I care about you, you should absolutely do what you feel like you should do and go be a dad, and we'll figure it out when you want to come back. And he was right. He was right about all of it. My career did suffer from it, I guess you could say. I mean, I wouldn't say horribly. I was still able to make Mr. Corman. So, you know, I couldn't really ask for more than that. But there's definitely plenty of opportunities that were coming to me that stopped coming. And, you know, is that stressful? In moments, yeah, I definitely have my moments where I'm like, you know, I can't believe that I let that happen. I had this incredible opportunity and I was, you know, I thought I was invincible. I didn't think that, you know, there'd be, but I knew because Warren told me what would happen. And ultimately it was 100% worth it. Like I'm so, so happy that I was able to spend more time with my family. And, you know, the stress, it comes and goes.
I love that he told you that. Honestly, I think it's, you know, I wish more people in corporate America would say that, right? Because he sort of laid it out to you. He gave you the stakes and he allowed you to make a good decision, it sounds mm-hmm. like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Radical candor.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Mr. Corman, it seems, I mean, he's a bit of a catastrophist. Like, you know, I definitely am as well. I mean, he goes to the deep, dark places. And did you purposely draw on that for him? Is that something that you had experienced? Did you think it was important to show that element?
Oh, yeah. that's I think that's part of my mind for sure. And, you know, I guess it's maybe drawn from the same place that why I like to tell stories or whatever is, you know, if you've got that muscle going in your mind that tells stories, you will make up catastrophic stories about horrible things that could happen.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
I have to say that for me, there were two scenes that felt so true to me as an anxious person. And they were very subtle. But the first one was when he's driving on the freeway. I lived in L.A. for 2 years. I'm an East Coaster, but I lived in L.A. for 2 years. And the freeway was seriously an impediment to my life because I would get so ridden with anxiety. And you have a scene where Josh is driving with his mom. I feel like it's on the 405 because they're heading up to Valencia. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But anyway,
you're right.
And he's driving super slow and he's super anxious. And his mom asks him about it. And do you get anxious driving on the freeway? That scene felt so true.
Yeah, I sometimes do. I really can't wait for self-driving cars.
The other scene that made me really cry was he goes to a breathing class.
Yeah.
Was that scene about loneliness and wanting to connect?
Yeah, that's, I think you said it really well. This is the episode that, and it's early in the season, that focuses most on Josh's anxiety.
Yeah.
And throughout, he's sort of trying to connect with people and failing over and over again to kind of have a resonant and meaningful connection with another person. And that's in many cases his own fault. And then in other cases, maybe not his fault. But he's also just, he's feeling really anxious. And early in the episode, someone says, "Have you tried focus on your breathing?" And he gets really angry and sort of flies off the handle at them. But by the end of the episode, when Victor, his caring friend, his happy gene caring friend, has sort of said to him, "Hey, I'm not going to leave you alone until you do something to deal with this. And he says that because Josh has been saying very negative things and even sort of joked about suicide, which Victor does not take lightly. And he's being a caring friend. And so out of other options, Josh does go to this breathing class that he's really reticent to go to. It's not the kind of thing he would usually go do. And unexpectedly, it's not really the breathing or the class that helps him, but he ends up sitting next to a woman, an older woman, and she only says a very brief thing. They're sort of going around the circle and talking, and she just says, "I was feeling very alone today," and in just such a simple and honest moment, he sort of feels like, "Ah, yeah."
And he reaches out for her hand, like it's so moving.
Yeah. So later, when they're lying together, sort of trying to do the breathing, he sees that she's crying about something, and he doesn't even know what. He doesn't say like, "Hey, what are you crying about?" He doesn't try to solve her problem or cheer her up or anything like that. They just kind of hold each other's hand and are lying there together. And, you know, sometimes maybe that's what it takes. You know, you can't necessarily solve the problem, but you can just be there for someone else. That's, like I said, I have a number of people that I care about a lot that struggle through anxiety. And what I have found is that it doesn't usually help to try to solve a problem. The best thing I can usually do is just kind of be there for them.
What has being immersed in this show taught you? And does it change maybe even how you're thinking about being a parent? And I think your kids are little, so the emotions are different, right? Mm-hmm. But are you seeing human nature differently, I guess, is my question?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, a lot of the show is about luck versus choice, which is another way of saying what are the things that you can control and what are the things that you can't control. Mm-hmm. And emotions are a funny one because as we've been talking about, some of them you can't control and some of them you can. It's not really simple. My whole skill, like what I'm really good at, is controlling my emotions. That's what acting is in a lot of ways. But I certainly can't just control them with the snap of the fingers. And the truth about acting is you don't just turn emotions on and off with a switch. I don't know, like maybe some actors can do that, but it's not how I do it. If you want the emotions to really ring true to an audience, you have to really feel them. And to really feel them, you have to kind of work your way into them. And so if I'm going to do a certain scene that's, for example, if the character's going through something emotionally intense, I can't just show up to work and be like, "Oh, hey, how's it going? Did you see the Lakers last night? Blah, blah, blah." And then say action and like all of a sudden be feeling that. The skill of acting and bringing those emotions into a scene has more to do with it's not exactly fakery. It's more kind of just knowing myself enough and paying attention to how I'm feeling enough and sort of gently nudging it throughout however long a time period it takes. But oftentimes it's like it's an all day thing, waking up knowing I'm going to do this scene and just kind of. You can't force it. If you force it, it'll look forced to an audience. But you're just kind of just gently, barely nudging it this way or that way with various tools or techniques, focusing my mind on, you know, given experiences or memories or stories or listening to music or you know, doing physical exercise even or any number of things that I do sometimes to kind of just nudge my emotions in one direction or another.
How do you do that if you want to have a good day with your kids and your wife, but like you have to go play a scene where your character's in crisis. How do you balance that?
Yeah, it's funny. You're picking up on, I said it starts when I wake up. Since being a dad, it doesn't start when I wake up. it used to when I was before that. But yeah. But now it starts when I walk out the door.
That's really disciplined. It's so funny what you're telling me, because you're talking about being incredibly mindful, right? And mindfulness is obviously a huge skill, but it sounds like part of your tradecraft is mindfulness.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to put it. I mean, yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. But you're absolutely right that a part of the what it means to act is paying a lot of attention to how I'm feeling.
When you played a tightrope walker, how did you summon that level? I read that you actually did it, which is terrifying. How did you summon that level of mental toughness and steeliness?
Well, just to clarify, I did learn to walk on a wire, but the wire I was walking on was 12 feet in the air. The guy I was playing walked on a high wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center, which not do in the slightest. He risked his life. I did not. I identified a lot with that. I you know, you don't risk your life when you act, but you know, for example, I got to do Saturday Night Live a couple times, and that feels very much like a high wire act because you're on live television, and so you can really mess up.
Yes.
And you have to not mess up. And yeah, the adrenaline is incredibly intense. It's probably more exhilarating than any experience I've had in my working life, because it's that component of live television. And also because SNL is like a pillar in my mind and upbringing that was very meaningful to me.
Do you feel like when you put something out there that's more personal, it's more of a high wire act, or does that not matter to you? Like something that you've written and created versus something that you may do, maybe just act in. Not that I'm minimizing acting, but you know what I mean.
For sure. No, I think it definitely does. And so putting Mr. Corman out into the world, yeah, definitely feels like higher stakes. And I definitely feel more sensitive to both sides when people like it. That's, you know, are liking it is putting it lightly. When people say things like some of the lovely things you've said today that I'm very grateful for, like that it really resonates, or it feels validating, or it feels relatable or illuminating. I mean, that's like, it means the world to me when I hear people tell me that. And on the flip side, when people say that they don't like it, or that or they say other negative things, that's like, it's really painful. Mm. you know, I feel like that's not something I want to shy away from. Of course, none of us want negativity in our lives, but I think you're always gonna have some if you're trying anything.
Yeah.
If you're trying anything, you're gonna risk some. There's some risk, and there's gonna be some failure, and there's gonna be some people or voices that say you suck, and you know that's just par for the course.
I love that. So you sort of try to keep like a learning mindset, like, okay, I'm going to take the feedback, but I'm going to keep going.
Yeah. If you can not dismiss the feedback, that's, I think, really elevated. I do my best to do that. And, you know, I think if, fingers crossed, don't know if we'll make a second season of Mr. Corman. but I actually find like some of the negative things that people have said, not all of them, but some of them, I actually think have been constructive for me. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll be able to make a second season that is better than the first. I really applaud that. I don't know that it's wise to listen to negativity. I think the most constructive feedback comes from people who are doing it caringly. And not everybody is caring in their criticism.
That's the understatement of the century.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like you've never been scared to explore whether it's you made a movie called Manic, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty stark portrayal, and your film Don John, which I think was the first movie you directed, was about a porn addict. Like, mm-hmm. you're not scared of exploring things that make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, those are the movies that I like the best. Usually, I definitely understand the desire for light entertainment. Personally, maybe it's just my own relationship with the medium, because I have spent my life on it. Light entertainment, if I want to escape or turn my mind off, like watching a movie or a show doesn't work that well for me. I'll do other things if I want some light entertainment, like maybe watch sports or watch like Shark Tank or listen to some music, or if I want to just like kind of relax. But if I'm going to watch a story in a movie or a show or something like that, the ones that really hold my interest are the ones that are really getting in there and are going to challenge me and are going to, you know, make me feel strong feelings or make me have to consider something I might not have thought of before.
My last question for you is a question I ask of most of my guests. Now, they're mostly like corporate executives and CEOs, but I'm going to ask it of you because I would assume that you manage people, right? You have people in your life, people on your team, people who you work with. How has the experience of making Mr. Corman, of going so deep into anxiety specifically, changed how you're going to be as a leader and a manager going forward?
Well, you're right. I mean, when directing Mr. Corman, certainly it's you don't usually use the word manager, but it is what you're doing. You're leading a team of people,
big time,
a cast and a crew, and I also run a company called Hit Record. I'm not the sole runner of it. I'm kind of part time at it because I do other things, but I am in a leadership position, and we have 40 employees at this point, and wow. So I've spent the last few years, because our company has grown, I've spent the last few years learning more explicitly about what it means to manage. And like I mentioned earlier, I read Radical Candor. So how has Mr. Corman affected that? I think that the feelings and experiences that the character is going through are things that I've lived and I've known about my whole life, but doing the show has made me really focus on it. And I think that's been very helpful, especially nowadays, because everyone's anxiety is on the rise in these extraordinary times during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's helped me be more empathetic and really try to put myself in the shoes of the people that I'm working with and what they're feeling, which to me is, that's what being a good leader is. You're all making something together, but you can't just think about, all right, I'm making this thing and all these people are going to help me. Like, I have to think about who are, okay, all those people, they're all people. they're a person just as much as I'm a person. They all have their feelings just as much as I have my feelings, and they all want things just as much as I want things. What is it that they want? What is it that they're feeling? How can I help them? And how can this be a positive experience holistically for them in their life, professionally and personally, because that's when they're going to, not because that's the right thing to do, but also because that is when everyone will do their best work. And I don't think it's like, I think those are kind of two sides of the same coin, that if your work is coming from a place of sincerity, it's not insincere to want everybody to do good work. And everybody getting to do good work is sort of one and the same with everybody leading a good life and being good people and finding meaning and happiness in the time that we spend alive. So I don't know. So I guess that just comes down to, yeah, treating people like whole people.
I like it.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. I wish you good health and great work and all the good things.
Thank you, Maura. It's really great talking to you.
That's it for today's show.
Thank you to my producer, Mary Dew. Thanks to the team at HBR. I'm grateful to our guests for sharing their experiences and truths. For you, our listeners, who ask me to cover certain items and keep the feedback coming, please do send me feedback. You can email me. You can leave a message on LinkedIn for me or tweet me at MoraAM. And if you love the show, tell your friends. Subscribe and leave a review. From HBR Presents, this is Maura Ahrens-Mealy.